Dear Dr. Pensa, are you going to do a part two for Life After Litigation? It seems like the last episode drove off a cliff without any warning. If not, can you please put an explanation in episode 13 that there are no more episodes coming, or rename it without the part two? Sincerely, Anonymous Doc. Yes, it's true. It's Gita. I am back. And we are going to do part two of Life After Litigation. But I want to start off by actually talking about this email for a second. I did say in part one that in part two, I would be talking a bit about my life after litigation. And as part of that, I want to get a little meta for a second and talk on the podcast about the podcast. So when I started this project, really in 2017 is when I started thinking about it. That was the year before my second trial started. It was really quite nebulous in my head. And it was a very personal project. I had no funding, no help. I did all the interviewing and concept work and editing and music, all of it by myself. And honestly, I had no idea if anyone would ever listen to it. I was almost doing it as a way to make sense of what had been happening to me and the things I had learned and the road I had traveled, and making something positive come out of this really horrific experience. But I had no idea if anyone would ever listen to it. And then a funny thing started to happen. Well, one, people started passing the podcast around to the point where now we're in the six figures for downloads of these few episodes. And I know it's used regularly as a teaching tool by residencies and hospital systems and lawyers and insurers who want their defendants to know that they're not alone in how they feel. And then I started getting lots of speaking invitations, you know, first the usual grand round circuit, and then it was groups of lawyers and professional societies and claims teams at insurance companies. And now I've done some really cool things, like I spoke at South by Southwest, and I'm in a documentary about medical malpractice called A World of Hurt, which is doing screenings right now, and I've been on Dr. Radio and things that I just really never saw coming. And people started to write to me. And sometimes they just wanted to get something off their chest. And sometimes they just asked if they could have a conversation. They were just so relieved to hear that someone understood them, that someone got it. And I did a lot of that. I did a lot of that before I ever had the idea planted in my brain that I could actually turn my attention from talking about the problem to really thinking about how to impact it and how to teach and coach doctors through it. Every time I spoke, I would hear more from doctors and other clinicians, frankly, who get sued about their fears or about what happened to them, what helped them, or that they were still suffering. And I became, frankly, obsessed. I mean, I was still a doctor, still practicing, had a couple of other jobs even in medical education. I've got three kids and aging parents and a husband and all the normal human squeezes, but I could not stop thinking about this. I started spending a lot of time when I probably should have been sleeping, working on this, thinking about this, not the podcast per se, but learning how to work with people one-on-one and then in groups, and how to train and teach and how to think about curricula and refining what I do when I coach and educate and how I speak. And I did some writing. I wrote an op-ed in Time last year that was really widely shared. And then organizations like hospitals, insurance companies started asking me to consult about how to better support their docs. And I have been doing as much as I felt like I could be doing while still doctoring and having all those human squeezes. And so when I got this email, and I'll say that most of the correspondence I get is really kind and encouraging, and I love all that. Please keep it coming. But when I got this email, I had to stop and think. Because my initial reaction was, dude, I have been very busy. But sometimes our initial reactive thought is not the one with the most insight. And so, as a coach tries to do sometimes, I thought a little deeper. And the truth was, I had already recorded and deleted this episode 3 times. I had never done that with the other episodes. And the truth was that I was procrastinating. And what we know about procrastinating is it usually isn't about time. I had overpromised. Somehow, I thought that in one episode, I was going to both tell you my whole story and impart all the lessons, tools, resources, maybe even wisdom that I have accumulated since starting this chapter of my life back in 2015, and about all the types of therapy like CBT or ACT and coaching and trauma work and cutting edge stuff in PTSD recovery and thoughts I have about how risk is taught and medical culture and all the things in one last grand episode. And the truth is, I can't do that. And so I just didn't do it for a while because it wasn't the most pressing thing. And, you know, I was doing this work in other ways, but I actually deep down knew what I needed to do, and it was daunting. And I didn't know if I could commit to it, you know, human life squeezing and all that. But to an even larger extent, I did not realize that some people, like the writer of this email or various other correspondents over the years, were waiting for me. Like 13 episodes in almost 5 years is no one's idea of a well-oiled machine, but I had never really had the thought that anyone was depending on it. And when I think about that, I think, well, my first thought is like, that's a lot. But my second thought is, man, I really want to get going. So, yes, I will say it out loud. I will be doing a second season of this podcast where we talk about all the things that we have to talk about, and I'm committing to at least one episode a month, maybe even two if I really get myself going. And maybe I won't make myself do all the editing, and maybe you'll stick with me while we talk about things like maladaptive perfectionism and self-compassion and normalizing our experience in this realm, but also how to change that experience because I think it's possible. I've done it, and more importantly, I have watched doctors and other clinicians that I have worked with and I have taught do it themselves. I do. I 100% truly believe, because I've lived it and I've watched it, I believe that post-traumatic growth is possible, that there is a way to do this well, no matter the events that landed you here, and that it is a good thing to know how to be a good defendant. That's a skill set we all should have. And to do that, you're going to have some techniques to learn and some attitudes to adjust. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to keep talking about how to perform well, teach you how the industry works. I'm pretty sure I'll bring up expert witnesses again. And in there, you'll probably get some of the touchy-feely stuff that you want to avoid, but I promise you is where the actual gold is. But for now, let us move on to the 4th version of this podcast, which is not necessarily any better than the 3 versions that came before it, but here I sit down with a friend and mentor, Dr. Mel Herbert, whose lovely Australian accent you heard very briefly at the beginning of part 1. Mel is an emergency physician and the founder of a company called Emergency Medicine Reviews and Perspectives, or EMRAP, where I am the co-host of a program for urgent care clinicians called UC Max. But before that, when we first met, it was in 2018, after my second trial, because he had heard the story of what happened, was intrigued, and asked me to sit down and talk about it with him in an interview for EMRAP. And so I thought it would be kind of fun to circle back 6 years later and talk about where I've been since then.
I want you to think back 6 years ago. Where were you? You're sitting here, you're in your car, you're working out. Think about 6 years ago. Where were you? And I can remember where I was in 2018. I was with Geeta Pensa, and we were talking about litigation stress. And she told me a story about a case that she had that went on for 1.8 million years, that was settled for $1.6 trillion. And there was something about dancing in an inappropriate dress. And now we're back for part
None
two.
None of those things actually happened, but I mean, close. You're very close.
I may have exaggerated a tiny bit.
That is not actually the way it went down. And if you will recall, in part one of Life After Litigation, I said that I would tell a little bit about the rest of the story and about my life after litigation. And so actually, yes, I did think that this would be fun to sit down with you because you, Mel Herbert, I should have you introduce yourself for those. If you're in emergency medicine, you know who Mel Herbert is. I've got to say that. But if you're not, let me introduce you to Mel Herbert. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So I'm Mel Herbert. I'm an ER doc, although I retired from working in the West a number of years ago. And I run a little education company, which is used by a fair number of ER doc people. And so I had the pleasure of interviewing Geeta on our show in 2018. And I thought it was really important because we're not taught how to deal with litigation stress. Even though we get sued quite often in emergency medicine, it destroys lives, it destroys careers. I thought it was one of the most important things we had done in many years. And I'm really interested to do the follow-up. Like, what happened now that you did that interview and you're trying to help other people get through this crap?
So let me rewind back even further to like 2015. So as you said, this was a case that lasted 2 trillion years. It was 12. Back in 2006 is when I saw this patient. And then when I got named, I don't really need to belabor how horrible it was because we've talked about that quite a bit in this series. But I felt like a lot of the voices that you've heard previously on this podcast, like I was completely decimated. And then I just remained that way for a really long time because there was nobody offering me any sort of instruction or a leg up or any way to understand this or put it in perspective. And a lot of my judgment was I was angry at myself for not being able to handle it. I handled all these other things, but I was so angry at myself for not being able to handle this. And in 2015, it was 4 years after I went to trial the first time in 2011, I went back to work and I was still miserable. And I just wanted to, I don't know, I wanted to do something else, except I had loans and I had to keep working and I just didn't know what else to do. I didn't think I had any other, you know, meaningful skills. I could crack a chest. That's it.
Like, all I could do is save lives. I'm useless for anything else.
That's all I could do. I was miserable. And then in 2015, my verdict got overturned and I found out I was going back to trial and I just didn't think I could do it. And I just hit this complete rock bottom place. And I thought that I was either going to just get swallowed absolutely whole, I had terrible thoughts, or I had to figure something else out. And had been at this point now, like the better part of a decade that I had just been literally just lost to this thing and miserable and miserable, depressed, anxious, just taking it out on everybody. And just, I wasn't myself for a really long time. I was hung up the phone. He basically told me to put my big girl pants on. Like I had to get myself back in gear. You're going to have to do it. He had been a special forces guy, ex-military, and you would follow him anywhere, honestly, now, but very different people, did not want to coddle me at all. And I just wanted to cry. I did cry for a long time. And then I kind of put my head up and I was like, I can't be like this. I'm done. I am absolutely done. And I did not know what else to do except to go and get this book out that someone had given me, knowing that I was struggling and I was ashamed of that anyway. But they gave me a book called When Good Doctors Get Sued. And I just went upstairs to my bedroom because I hadn't read it. I'd kept it in the drawer of my bedside table. But like once in a while, I would look at the title and think like, oh, good doctors do get sued. That's nice. And I would shut it. And then I felt like ready for the first time, like, all right, let me sit down and start reading it. And I was very skeptical that it was going to help me, but I had to do something. And lo and behold, just reading someone else talking about the things that I was feeling and explaining to me that this was kind of expected and normal was the first time I'd started to feel any kind of relief. And when that happened, when I was like, you sort of broke the self-help seal, right? Because I'd been like, I don't do self-help. Who needs that? I don't need that. I'm smart and capable, and this sort of thing doesn't happen to me. Once I broke that seal and I realized, oh my gosh, this is the only way I'm going to get better, I started.
That message that you just gave, which is, and I'm going to say it a different way, Gita, you're not special.
No.
When you're going through something terrible, we think that we're special. We think the only ones that are feeling this way. We think we're the only ones that are depressed and sad, that everybody else looks like they suck it up and are fine. And I think the thing that I have learned from your story and then my story, which is very different, but becoming very depressed and sad and horrible after I left clinical medicine and I left my business, was that it's not a new story. So you picking up that book and going, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one who is a good doctor who's got sued and felt depressed and sad and didn't want to go to work. That's the first thing I think people have to understand. And that's really hard for type A physicians that have always been at the top of their class and always exceeded every expectation to be able to say, I don't feel good. And to know that you're with a lot of people who don't feel good, who feel bad, and that this whole process is terrible, and that people that go through it are not Navy SEALs. They're doctors and they're human. And you brought that out in that 2018 interview. And I thought that was so important because physicians go through this every day. Hundreds, thousands of physicians. Gita, you're not special.
No. No, it turns out that I'm not. My story was long, but not singular, really, in any way. And so when I started finally getting help and realizing, like, you know what, I don't think we think about this right, I started making changes. And I started, you know, that wasn't the only self-help book I read. Then I started getting more. And I started literally as the good doobie. I would highlight things and write notes in the margins. And then I would try all the exercises and with a real earnestness that I had not had before. I think you actually have to hit some sort of, I don't know, some real piece of vulnerability inside yourself to say, like, I'm going to try this exercise. The book says maybe it's going to help. I'm going to try it. And I'm going to mean it when I try it. And you know what? When you mean it, when you try it, you start to discover, like, oh, this does kind of interesting things to my mind and my mood. And that's interesting. I'm not special. Like, and so then one thing led to another. And then I actually really got to be in a far better mental place. And I started studying more things like, mm-hmm. you know, other cognitive neuroscience stuff and tort law and, you know, resilience stuff and meditation. And I started trying all sorts of stuff, and some of it stuck and some of it didn't, but all of it sort of helped to put me in this place where I could become more of an observer of what was going on in my brain and trying things and thinking, does this help? Does this not help? Okay, that's not helping so much, but like this thing is probably helping. Let's do more of that. And for a long time, it was just an inside job. But I mean, it had a lot of collateral benefits for the people around me and my husband and my family, and everything sort of seemed better. And then I started to decide that I had to figure out what to do with work. I was happy as a person. Now I was feeling a lot better. I mean, litigation was still going on. I was still going to go to trial again. That was looming. And yet somehow I'd learned how to make peace with that, all the ways that we've been talking about. But I was like, you know what? Litigation be damned. I got to figure out if I like medicine anymore. And so then I started, as one does, trying to climb out of burnout in all the various ways. And what I did find was, and someday I hope to talk about this more, but really looking at what I did in every single day with pretty deep respect for what I had been taught to be able to do. It's pretty impressive what we go out there and do every single day. And looking for small, really, it wasn't in the trauma bay. It was really in these small interactions with people where you really got to connect, just help a little kid with asthma, make someone's day a little bit better, you know, really relishing those moments. I cut out in one of those little throwaway ER newspapers, someone wrote an essay about the spiritual satisfaction of being the person who took care of society's forgotten, the homeless or the chronic schizophrenic, and maybe being the only person who was nice to them that day. Mm. And I cut that thing out and I carried it in my pocket for like a long time. And I mean, it was emergency medicine in general. There was a lot of crap to deal with. But it brought me back to the appreciation of focusing in on what it was that I was doing there every single day. And then I started making other decisions that I thought would benefit me and my career and my happiness. I joined an academic faculty. And when I got there, I went to the residency director and I was like, I'm a generalist. I don't have a niche. What do you do in an academic faculty? And she was so great. She was just like, you know, we need someone to help with again, this is like back around 2015. We need someone to help with the blogs and podcasts or all these things coming out the residents want to use. You know, we need like an educational technology, social media person. I was like, I know nothing about that, but I'll learn, I'll try. And that is what actually brought me to the residents wanted to make a blog. We did that. Then they wanted to learn how to podcast. And so I went to a class taught by none other than Jess Mason.
What?
Of your company, EMRAP. I don't think that's how you found me in terms of like interviewing me for this thing. I think you found me some other way that you got in touch with me. But either way, that's how I wound up kind of getting more connected with you and starting this idea of podcasting about this.
I don't remember how, but I remember when I heard what you were doing that we had to have it on the show. We do a little bit of litigation stuff every now and then, but it not to the detail that you go into. We sort of have talked a little bit about, well, here's a little bit of how the process goes, but really haven't delved deep into the psychological damage and how you can get through that and the skill set you need to develop if you're going through that. And I didn't have it in residency. I was told in residency, you're going to get sued a few times. It's just business. Suck it up. And you're sort of like Navy SEAL. It's like, just suck it up and that's part of the job and you'll be fine. I got named and I was terrified and I thought I was a terrible doctor. And for weeks and months afterwards, I did lots more tests than I should have because, you know, I missed an epidural abscess, spinal epidural abscess. And, but then it got dropped and I went, it didn't produce that much psychological stress, but for a long time I saw the patients as the enemy. Mm-hmm. Like, which one of you is going to sue me next? Mm-hmm. Is that what you had?
I did. I was afraid of the patients. I was afraid of them suing me. I was also afraid of just hurting someone or missing something. And I just felt like the whole place was just like a minefield. And I would literally cry on my way into a shift. I didn't want to go. And somehow when I was there, I could sort of just do the job. And then I was so happy when the shift was over. But it's amazing how long a person with grit and determination who had enough determination to become a doctor, it's amazing how long you can keep doing that. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how long you can just keep showing up miserable day in, day out, day in, day out. And I think a lot of people are doing that. For me, litigation was the primary driver of winding up there. But then once I was in it, that was all I could see was just the misery and the fear.
It's like med school and residency, right? It's a hard, terrible thing that most people couldn't possibly do, but we do it and we talk about, you know, how hard med school was and waking up in the middle of the night without, you know, with dreams we were naked doing the chemistry exam and getting it wrong and residency really hard. So it doesn't surprise me that you had the grit to go through that because we get trained to do that. Doesn't mean it's healthy.
Right.
So did all this podcasting and learning these new skills help in this?
Well, yeah, actually, interestingly. So I wanted to do it in a different way. So the first thing I thought of was, let me start doing interviews with people. And so in 2017, I went on social media and I started asking people if they wanted to talk about their experience in litigation. And I was just blown away by how many people answered and wanted to talk about it. And that became I sifted through all of that. And I, you know, I'm not a researcher. Like now I'm like, oh, I wish I did like a qualitative research thing with this, but I didn't. I just was like, oh, these are good stories. These are really compelling voices. I'm going to make sort of this curriculum. And then, I mean, back in the day, I did all the editing by myself. Like, I just learned how to edit from Jess Mason. Like, let me see what I can do. And so in some ways, the podcast was really helpful for me because, you know, I knew my story, but being able to hear it from a lot of different people in a lot of different ways was the first step that I had into realizing, like, wow, there are themes that really come up in this over and over and over again. And so I started laying the groundwork. And then after trial, when I finally put the thing out, I started getting a lot of correspondence from people. Just people started passing it around by word of mouth. And then I found out it was being used, you know, as a teaching tool and everywhere from residencies to med schools to like, there's a law school class that uses it. There's a master's in healthcare leadership program that uses it. Defense attorneys now use it. I think all that stuff is awesome. But where it really started was just, I just really wanted people to know I guess in your words, that they weren't special.
Exactly. Like they're average.
You're average. Like this is how we all feel. And that there are reasons why we feel like that. Honestly, I don't think that this experience has to be the career ending, potentially life ending, as we've discussed, this horribly traumatic experience. I don't know that it has to be as traumatic as it has historically been if we were able to make certain changes. So for me, you know, I was like this social experiment. I was like trial A and then this intervention where all these things changed in my life and I helped change myself. And then I had trial B. And by the time I showed up at trial B, I was a completely different person. I knew about the law. I knew my role. I had spent the 4 months before that preparing for the ballroom dance competition.
Yes.
You and I spoke about in our first go around. So for people who don't know that story, I will say very quickly that what I did was put preparation for the podcast aside. I was still preparing for the trial, but I signed up for this charity ballroom dance competition called Dancing with the Doctors that they were doing in Rhode Island. And I trained with this amazing, like, it's like Dancing with the Stars, or they model it after that anyway. They match you up with these professional ballroom dancers and you train and then you compete at this big gala with like 1,000 people watching, literally. And I'm wearing this like tiny skimpy dress. And so I was like very concerned with getting myself in good shape. And my partner had been the 3-time Czech Republic ballroom dance champion before coming to the United States. He was this like incredible dancer and also a serious taskmaster. And I did nothing but think about this competition, not my trial, for months. And the date of the gala was 1 week before my trial was supposed to start, which is precisely why I signed up for it. And that night was one of the greatest nights. I was really honest about why I was doing it. I shook everyone I knew down for money. So many of the people that I worked with, like nurses, staff, hospital admin, like so many people came to this thing. They like made signs. Mm-hmm. I won. I had literally one of the best nights of my life. My family was there, friends from all over. It was phenomenal. And a week later, I walked into trial. And I was ready. Like, I didn't know what would happen. You can't ever know what's going to happen, but I knew I was ready. And I invited my residents to come watch me testify.
Wow.
Come watch and learn. See how this is done. I don't know when you're going to get a chance to do this again. And I testified for a day and a half, like, honestly, like a total boss. Like, I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I carried it off. It did serve me well. We wound up with a defense verdict again, and they declined to appeal. Actually, in that interview with you in 2018, we took a break and I was going through my email. That's when I found out they decided not to appeal. It was literally during the interview that you and I were doing. Mm-hmm. And so I was like done at that point. And then I was just like, I just want to get to work. I want to start helping people with this. I want to just keep learning and learning and learning and learning. And you said something really interesting a minute ago about how doctors are trained. And that, I think, is one of the principal reasons why litigation stress is, for many people, a stressor like no other in their entire lives. There's four reasons. Would you like to hear about my theory of the four factors, Mel?
There is nothing I would like to hear more than the theory of the four factors. This is like the three body problem. I can see it coming. Go.
So, I mean, I think there are four reasons why this is so, so very difficult for us. And the first has to do with the psychology of physicians themselves. So medicine selects for basically perfectionists, right? You have to have a certain amount of grit. You have to have a certain amount of resilience. And you have to be a perfectionist who is willing to jump through all the hoops and get all the grades and do all the stuff. And those people actually tend to be people that are kind of hard on themselves when they don't hit the mark. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but that's a lot of us. That's how we got to where we were. So that's one problem. The next is that the culture of medicine completely encourages that, right? So it selects for these people, and now they put this into an environment where the name of the game is blame and shame. You know, you're in this competitive environment, you're still expected to perform at this certain level all the time. You are taught that to some degree you are supposed to be exempt from normal human physical needs, from normal human emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. And that sort of woven into us this belief that we are, you know, none of us would say like, oh, I'm a superhero. But we do somehow believe in there that we are supposed to be exempt from those things.
Yep.
And medicine has really taught us to believe that. We got, and in some ways that serves us, right? Like that's how we did residency. That's how we, these surgeons stand up for like 3 days doing a surgery. Like this is, how else were we going to do it? But now you take that person who is a total perfectionist, who's trained that environment. Now that's the language they speak. That's what's flowing through their veins. They believe that they're responsible for everything that happens to a patient. And they sort of believe that they're never supposed to screw up.
Mm-hmm.
They intellectually understand that it has to happen at some point, but it's really not supposed to. Now you take that person and you drop them in. This is the third factor. You drop them into litigation and they don't know a thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like not one thing. And so that now the third problem is this naivete of the physician who winds up here. And they think the law is supposed to work like medicine. And they think that the way that they've behaved all along is going to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're blind to the emotional manipulation that goes into it. They just don't understand it. They don't know what's happening. They're completely oblivious. And so they take the process personally and punitively. And then the last thing is the legal system itself. Like just the way it works is just you find out once you get there, like how it works with the expert witnesses, that the judge doesn't understand medicine, that the jury doesn't understand medicine. You are, this is the first time you're really like letting this stuff sink in.
Mm-hmm.
And none of it feels good. You feel like everything about you is going to be determined by this process that you don't understand, can't control, and nobody in it understands anything about medicine. So If you take this person whose whole identity and being is wrapped up in this and you do this to them, like
it destroys people. One of my mentors said in a funny way, you can call me a bad spouse. You can call me a bad parent, but don't you ever call me a bad doctor. I take that stuff personally. And it's sort of a fun way of saying what you said about sort of the culture of medicine and the physician psychology. We have so much of our ego vested in being a good and smart doctor. And we have been told you'll make mistakes and just exactly as you should, but we don't believe that we are allowed to. And so if you make a mistake, that's terrible. If you make a mistake and then his job is to make everybody around you believe that you're an idiot, which is what this process is about, it can be soul-destroying, completely soul-destroying.
So what I think is that a lot of these things can actually be influenced. I mean, once you start to recognize, oh, this is where the origins of this great distress come from, what in this process is actually something that you can start to push back against?
Mm.
And people would just call me. They'd like find me at Brown and be like, can I just talk to you for half an hour? I just want to talk to you about what's happening in my life. And then somebody introduced me to coaching, which was really, now up to that point, I'd been doing therapy at this point. I had been coached in other ways, not life coaching, but professionally and things like that. I was open to all this stuff. And then somebody was like, maybe you should be a coach. And I hadn't really known much about what coaching was or the discipline of coaching. And so I started learning more about that and getting some training in that. And what I know now is that there are tools that people can use and ways of reframing this experience that can make it much less soul crushing because you start to understand that your thoughts about litigation aren't facts about litigation. The meaning that we derive from it is not actually the meaning. And reframing this as just actually an occupational, not even occupational hazard, more of an occupational inevitability, and that you are allowed to learn how to do this well and also how to live your life despite the fact that this is going on. You can learn to be a meaningful member of your defense. You can learn to influence the things you can influence, get a sense of what can I and what can't I influence in this process. And you can learn how to process your feelings about litigation, about whatever the adverse event was, about you as a human being and as a doctor who is trying to do good on this earth. And you can learn how to keep those two things separate so that your emotions don't drive the bus when you are in the hot seat of deposition, but you're not completely suppressing everything so then it blows up like a volcano when you're, you know, when your dog has an accident inside or whatever. It's, there are ways that we can actually do this better. And it's been really interesting working, because I didn't know any of these tools. No one ever taught me these things. I wish I'd learned them a long time ago. And one of the really honestly great things that I've been able to do in the last several years is learn how to teach these tools to physicians, teach them more about coaching themselves through the process. And then I've gotten to watch them now from early in the process to trial or to like get dropped or through settlement or whatever. And not only is it possible for them to really put litigation in the box, you know, that it's supposed to be in, right? Not where it doesn't seep out into the rest of their life, but they can use it even as a catalytic experience for post-traumatic growth, where you start to look at your life in a more full way, think about the changes that you want to make in your own career, think about the changes that you want to make in your own life, course correct where you need to, and really use this as a clean slate moment to say, where am I? What am I doing? Where do I want to go from here?
This is a huge lesson for all life stresses. When terrible things happen, we never want terrible things to happen, no matter what it is. But if you can do the jujitsu of it, if you can learn how to be resilient through it and appropriately grieve it and learn from it, you can come out better at the other end. The only way you get bigger muscles is if you go to the gym and work out and it hurts and you sweat and you're like, I don't want to do this. You can come through this with a little training and a little coaching and be better for it. So tell us something about that. What does that mean now for you?
Well, first, on the broader scale, what I want is for people who are going through this, who weather it well, who learn things, to talk about their experiences. I think the only way that we're going to affect culture is by people being much more open, much more vulnerable, much more able to talk to their learners about their experiences. In even if you're brave enough, in real time, like I am getting sued. You don't give all the details, but like what's in the complaint is public record. I am getting sued. It is a difficult experience. However, I am learning to do XYZ. I am taking care of myself like this. That's really important. You mentioned grief. Grief I use as a construct for teaching. Mm-hmm. Grief is a framework that everybody understands. And so even if you enter into a relationship knowing that there very well may be grief in some way ending this relationship, you don't look forward to it. But you've seen people work through it. You've seen people lose their partners. You've seen it in movies and books. And you know that there's a way through it, even if it feels like the worst possible thing when it happens. You know that there's hope. In litigation, you don't know that. You never got to see anybody do it. It's not in the books. It's not in the movies. Nobody's ever shown you that there is a way to get through this and to be whole and even better on the other side. And so what I hope is that the more people who talk about it and who do weather it well, the more moral models of resilience there will be for younger people coming up through this so that it doesn't have to be this devastating. It will never be fun. It will never be easy, but it doesn't have to be devastating. And impacting the shame around it is going to be thing number one. Another thing I'd like to see is, and again, this isn't a well-oiled machine by any stretch, but I really do hope that I can start doing more educational programming. I've got the beginnings of a course I'd like to get out there. I have been working on the outline of really everything I think that people would need to know so that they would have the skill set and the mindset that they need to do those two main goals. One, to be able to be a meaningful part of their defense, and two, to be able to process the emotions around the adverse event, around the litigation itself, and to sort of steer themselves towards a path of growth like we were just talking about. Those two things have to be done separately, and learning how to do that, there's skills that you can cultivate. So yes, I want to do more of this. I want to do more teaching. I hope to resurrect, you know, maybe a season two of this where we just talk about topics around risk management or around the tools that I teach about when I coach people. And that's the hope, you know, anonymous physician. I'll get it all out. But I do aspire to do that. And when I do, I hope you'll all be here listening.
What? So you went through it twice. And I know people who have done it poorly and people have done it well. If you can do it well, what does that look like? What does that, what does well mean in this context? Nobody wants to go through it. It's terribly stressful. It is an enormous psychological weight to carry. Mm-hmm. But if you have the skills and can do it well, what does it look like compared to somebody who doesn't do it well?
I believe that doing it well means coming to a place of acceptance around the events, the medical events that happened and what your role in them was, and seeing that clearly. Coming to a place of equanimity, processing those things. What does it mean to be a doctor involved in an event in which someone was hurt? What does it mean to be a doctor who works in the arena every day when it's full of risk? Like, what does it mean to make a mistake? What does it mean to be involved in this way? To integrate that into who you are as a physician and a human being moving forward, trying to cultivate some degree of wisdom from that, that's important. And if you can also learn the skills, you know, use these tools to learn how to operate in this, on this other planet. It's like being on another planet, being involved in these legal things. Learning how to do that with skill so that you can execute really what you need to accomplish in the deposition or giving testimony or helping your attorney with strategizing around your case. That's weathering this well also. Maintaining your relationships, maintaining your physical health, and using this as this is part of your life. This is happening to you in your life, seeing this as something that was kind of always going to happen. If you work in medicine, this was always going to happen in some way, shape, or form. Incorporating that into who you are as a human, learning what you can from it, and then knowing that you can come out stronger, better, different on the other side, that to me is weathering this well.
This is such an alien experience. I'll tell you a story again told to me by Greg Henry, I think. Got sued, is on the stand, getting just decimated by the lawyer, being made to feel terrible, being made to be like, this is the worst doctor we've ever seen. And this was so such an easy case. And, you know, your grandmother could have made this stuff, all of this stuff that they do to like bring the jury on side, and just feeling terrible. And then the case is over and everything. And that same lawyer contacted the doctor and said, would you mind being an expert witness for me on this other case? I thought you really did really well on the stand, and I thought it was you were great. And this doc's like, what is happening here? You just made me feel terrible. And to them, as Greg was pointing out, this was just business. This is just a game, and this is business, and this is how it's played. But to that doctor, it was like, this isn't business. This is my life. You're making me feel bad. But as Greg used to talk about, look, if you can see it through their eyes, then you can become better at that performance.
Exactly.
And you don't take it personally, and you can leave the room going, I did a really good job here, like a good resuscitation. But you do have to disambiguate everything you've learned in medicine and about being a human, and understand you're about to enter alien world where all the rules are different. And doctors just don't know that. And I am so excited about you doing this, because we need to know that world exists, because every now and then we have to go visit that world.
You do. You do. And the more you know about the more you can reframe it as, I mean, think about how lawyers are trained for a moment. The plaintiff's attorney, like, they sleep very well at night. They believe that they are doing what they were put on this earth to do. As a lawyer, you are trained that what is right and just and good is for you to fight for your client. If you are a criminal attorney, that person could be a child killer and you could know it. And your job, what is right and just and fair for you to do, is to zealously defend the rights of your client no matter what. That's your job. Mm-hmm. The only way you can feel good about yourself is by doing what you are taught the right thing to do is, right? The plaintiff's attorney is doing what they believe the right thing to do is. And so it's not personal. they have been taught all these various techniques and lines of questioning and ways of making you psychologically manipulated, this and that. And they're not doing it to be evil. They're doing it to fight for their client, and they're doing it for a buck. Let's not, you know, put too fine a point on it, but you know, they really think they're doing well by doing good. They truly do. In the process of this, I have talked to plaintiff's attorneys. I've gotten kind of friendly with one of them. They see themselves as the good guys. They do.
Yeah, they see themselves as protecting the world against terrible doctors.
They do.
And this is the system that they're working in. Like,
yes.
That's why they see it, because they have to sleep at night.
That, and I don't even know that they're... That's how what they were taught was right. Like, we were taught a certain way of thinking in medical school. They were taught a certain way of thinking in law school. Mm-hmm. That to them is justice. So the meaning that we assign to things in this world, like, none of that serves us. One of the things we learn about in coaching is the ability to segregate your thoughts and feelings from facts. And so getting to the nitty gritty about what are the facts in this situation and teaching physicians the best way to get through this is if you have basically a non-intersecting Venn diagram. Like, you've got your thoughts and feelings about litigation and the events and what this means about you as a person and all of that stuff. That is like in one independent circle. And in the other independent non-intersecting circle is my job as a defendant. Mm-hmm. And never the twain shall meet. And if you can do that, you're going to weather it well.
You've aced every test. You are at the pinnacle of education. You're the best student of the best students of the best students. You just have to accept the fact that now you have to learn a new set of skills, and you should be the best at it. And that can actually, I think, can be a very positive thing. I'm going to go into this fight well trained.
Yeah. And you deserve to. And that's another thing we have to get through, is a lot of times people come into this feeling like something bad happened and I don't deserve to fight. I don't deserve to defend myself, and I don't deserve really to be happy. Mm-hmm. Deep down, I should be miserable because this thing has happened. And that's something that we also have to work on is, yeah, there's going to be suffering associated with that. But if it's an integral part of being a physician, do you have to suffer forever when something bad happens? Because it always will. There always will be something when you are working in that arena, in those gray zones with incomplete information. You're never going to get it right 100% of the time. And if you sentence yourself to a life of misery when it doesn't go right, is that really how it should be?
Mm-hmm. I see two big things here, and I'm sure your program will touch on both of them, but it's exactly as you said. There's two things that are going on. One, we don't want to hurt people. We feel bad. Our job is to make people better, not to miss things. So that's one set of things we have to learn how to do, because you will miss things. You will make mistakes. People will get hurt. And then there's the system thing. There's the legal thing, which is then piling on top of those feelings that you have to work through. And you need to learn how to defend yourself against that second group with the lawyers in the strange world. But there are two worlds there. And one is us as physicians being better at, we are going to make mistakes, but really understand that. And then the second one is not letting the system take you from a sad person who's trying to work through that to destroying people. And that's what I hate about the legal system. And I think most physicians I know hate it, because they know, I've tried to do everything right. Something went wrong. I'm already feeling bad and I'm trying to work through that. Now there's a system that absolutely is going to try and destroy me, because there is lots of reasons for that, financial and otherwise. Some countries don't do that anymore. And you might want to go to New Zealand, but first you're going to have to defend yourself against this case here with this system. This is the system that you are in. You have to play by the rules of this system. So that's why I think what we did with you in 2018 was so important. And what you're doing now, I think, is so important to reframe this. Nobody has really done it well. There's a little bit here and a little bit there, but this is a whole program, a whole different way of thinking that you can't get with your lawyer in 30 minutes. When I got named, I got a 10-minute spiel on how things were going to be. That was not adequate. I needed 10 hours of therapy and understanding, and I didn't get it. Most people don't get it. And then the next thing they look up, oh, I'm in the middle of a courtroom, and I've had no training in this.
Yeah. So we need to start doing this earlier. We need to start talking about these things openly well before people are ever named in litigation. In an ideal world, they would come in and already have a pretty good idea of what this is all about. And so we've got work to do.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get busy.
Oh, get busy. What are you doing? Come on.
Yes. So I will hopefully be back.
You'll be back.
I'll be back. We are gonna really try to nail down soup to nuts, everything you need to know, start here and there. And I think it'll be a start.
I think it's gonna be more than a start. You are a singular expert at this now. You're also a singular podcaster. And it's going to be more than a start. I really think that what you're creating and about to create is life-saving for physicians. Career life-saving for physicians. And you're not going to state it that way, but I am. What Gita's doing is effing important stuff that hasn't really been done like this before. There you go. I said it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mel. I also want to thank, as we wrap up this, hopefully just the first season of Doctors Litigation, I have a lot of people to thank. Mel, thank you so much for kicking it all off. And all the doctors who have lent your voices, your stories, it has not gone unnoticed. You have helped many, many, many people. And I would like to think that your voice was in each of those people's ears, helping them along. So thank you. Thank you to our experts that we've had all along the way. The work that I'm doing stands on the shoulders of some people who've come before me. And thank you to everybody who's listened to this, passed it along to other people that you think might need it. Thank you to the attorneys and the insurers who hand it their defendants and say, this might be helpful. Thank you to everybody who has written to me over these last several years. Really, it's been pushing me forward and giving me the feeling of so much meaning in this work. It's very important to me. And thank you to the doctor who wrote to me and said, where the hell is this podcast?
Thank you, Mystery Doctor.
Thank you, Mystery Doctor. You know who you are. All right, everybody. I'll see you guys next month. I mean it.